Books and Middle Eastern Studies. I'm Banaf Shinija. My guest, Asad Al-Saleh, is Assistant Professor of Arabic, Comparative Literature and Cultural Studies in the Department of Languages and Literature and the Middle East Center at the University of Utah. His research focuses on issues related to autobiography and displacement in Arabic literature and political culture in the Arab world. His book, Voices of the Arab Spring, Personal Stories from the Arab Revolutions, is narrated by dozens of activists and everyday individuals, documenting the unprecedented events that led to the collapse of dictatorial regimes in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen. Asad Al-Saleh, welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Asad, I'm wondering if you could begin by saying a few words about yourself. You're not limited to these questions, but where you were born, where you went to school, how you became interested in literature, specifically autobiographies.
Oh, sure. I was born in Syria, a small town on the Euphrates called Al-Salhiya. And it was, I grew up in a very nice environment. I remember my early years, we didn't have electricity in the town. It was all like part of the, what I read now, the pre-Islamic poetry, kind of the same culture where you feel everything around you is nature, not a lot of connection actually with what's going on politically or even socially. So I grew up in a very kind of remote area in Syria. Al-Bukamal is part of Deir ez-Zor, and this is like the last cosmopolitan area before you go to Iraq from the eastern region of Syria. Technically, if you are talking about Damascus being the center of Syria, this is the farthest that you can imagine. Went to school there for my primary education. My secondary school was in the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is kind of the governorate of that region. Went to Damascus University for my bachelor degree, which was in English literature. Finished also a kind of postgraduate degree. Then moved to Kuwait for 2 years, teaching there for secondary school kids. 2000 till 2002, end of 2002, I came to the United States. Also started my postgraduate education in Kansas, finished MA in English literature, then decided that this is not my thing. I mean, I like literature, I like English literature as well, but I felt I need to go back to my language and heritage and moved to the University of Arkansas to study basically comparative literature, but the reason for it was to find some academic training in Arabic literature, and I had wonderful experience there. 2010, moved to University of Utah after finishing my PhD as assistant professor. Was involved immediately in the Arab Spring, I mean intellectually, writing the book right after it happened. And since then, I am kind of pretty much following up with what's going on in the Arab world, in addition to other interests that I try to cover in my writing and scholarly contribution.
So were you interested in autobiographies before the Arab Spring?
Yes, I was interested in it since I think 2003 when I first wrote my graduate paper on Edward Said and Fawaz Turki. Fawaz Turki is also a Palestinian author. He's not as prominent as Edward Said though, but he's more like mouthful about his experience in the refugee camps in Lebanon and through the other areas that he was forced to leave after being displaced from his town in Palestine. So I found the contrast between his style and Edward Said's style in Out of Place, the popular memoir, very interesting, and I start writing on them. And then I realized that maybe other Palestinian experiences will be more like informing the intellectual approach to autobiography based on a certain like pattern of grievances. And I found that displacement is the major grievance among the Palestinians who wrote autobiography. So I tried to collect as many as I could a number that's manageable in a dissertation. And I wrote mine since 2003, starting focusing on my dissertation. And it was basically on displaced Palestinians who wrote autobiographies. And I'm trying to see what are the kind of ethics and issues that we see in an autobiography written primarily by displaced people. A project that I should go back to and maybe put it in a book format. Yeah, that's actually the origin of my interest in autobiography. When the Arab Spring came, I had an eye on seeing how people would react to it, because the Arab Spring is like a cultural moment, the same as displacement for the Palestinians. So I tried to find out what would the Arabs say about this moment, as the Palestinian did back in the 50s or the 60s. But I realized this is not going to happen, like you wait and then people will do that. Because, you know, it's not like the typical product that you expect from any moment. I assume you know that we would expect a lot of journalism coming from the region covering the Arab Spring, and maybe other books trying to theorize about it. So I felt maybe we should give voices to those who are participating in the Arab Spring, see their kind of what they say about it, and if there was a chance to get them write about it in an autobiographical format, that would be great. And the idea, I think, came to me during 2011. I was also teaching a course on literature and revolution. And I realized that rather than just tell my students about what historians said about popular revolutions, whether the Bolshevik, the French, the American, I wanted actually to include personal narratives, even as remote they are, that just to have a flavor of what people felt about, say, the Bolshevik revolution or the American Revolution or the French Revolution. It was hard to find such narratives. You find tons of historical enterprises, but not kind of the oral history collection of narratives. And I felt like that might be the same with the Arab Spring if we wait without doing something like this, so that people will tell their stories, and in the future, anyone who is interested in the Arab Spring will go back to these narratives and say, hey, let's listen to the Arabs themselves. What did they say about their revolutions? And started from there, just the idea, which I, when I go back, I really appreciate the idea more than the process, because the idea was kind of the drive to accomplish all this.
Could you tell me a little bit about the participants? How did you find them? What was their social educational backgrounds? What was their political commitments?
It was actually set in this way. The Arab Spring has been labeled as a Facebook revolution or Twitter uprisings and so on. I tried to use the same medium that has given these people the means by which they can voice their dissent, organize their protest movements, and try to find out from the same social media world that they created to push for change, go to that world and try to connect myself with these people. So I used actually a Facebook account, and I tried to jump from one Facebook page to another, looking for the major Facebook pages that were in a way in charge of organizing sit-ins and organizing protest demonstrations, and try to see who's active and what are the names over there, check kind of the verification of these people, try to connect with them through private chatting. It was a little bit time-consuming, but eventually I could actually make a net But that was not the only way. I also tried to meet people. There are many people in the U.S. who were originally from Syria, Yemen, or Egypt, Libya even. So I tried also to connect with real people, I mean, someone like you, and say, hey, do you know anybody in Cairo or Egypt in general who is actually from this youth movement, participants in the Arab Spring who might be interested in telling their stories. And word of mouth helped a lot to actually connect with people throughout the process. I'll also try to even contact some, you know, in academia we have our listserv, so try to see if someone in Middle Eastern universities know some people who are participating in this, and then try to connect with them. I think the collection was the hardest process, just to get people, because once you try to convince them that this is a worthwhile project, mostly they would agree to start the process. But a lot of times people will feel like, why would I even respond to you? We have by then the Facebook world and the Twitter is kind of overwhelmed to the degree that you might find a lot of people who are trying to connect with you, and you're not necessarily in the belief that they are who they said they are, usually fake names and stuff like that. So a lot of people, kind of, I would say maybe thousands, ignored my call for help. But eventually we got enough number to cover the Arab Spring from as many aspects as possible. In terms of backgrounds, I tried actually to start the focus on the gender balance, because a lot of people were, even before the Arab Spring, I mean, it was always kind of the male who is first approached and they will tell what they think. And I think during the Arab Spring, the balance of gender was always there, so you have to keep it up. And I try to mix my narratives, usually half men, half female. And it worked on that ground very well. I'm satisfied with the distribution. But even within that scale, I try to find people from different backgrounds. And finding, for example, someone from Egypt who is either a taxi driver or someone who just sells bread, which the latter I had a story from that person, someone who was just selling falafel and not educated, basically. It was not easy to get, because you cannot get these people by Facebook or by listservs or even academic or even personal connections. But I eventually, from some of the participants, I realized they know thousands of people. So some participants helped me to connect with others. So once you know a few participants who are willing to coordinate with you, it's easy to tell them, I need someone like from this type of educational background or from this class. I want a writer, someone who is interested in journalism, and they would help. And I really, really appreciate all my participants in the book. They are like the best you can work with, because they helped a lot to connect me with even some female participants who were eventually not available. Like I tried to get the account of Tawakkul Kerman, I think before she got the award, the Nobel Prize, because she was very active. I tried to connect with other people, like what we call big names, but not all of them I could reach. At the same time, I was very happy that I could cover different backgrounds, class, political commitments. Mostly at that time, they were anti-regimes. I didn't check a lot about their political backgrounds, because they were kind of unified with this moment. None of them actually tried to emphasize their prior Arab Spring affiliation, political affiliation. I remember I could actually get the account of a popular Syrian descent figure, Radwan Ziada, for example. And basically, he didn't focus a lot on what he did before the Arab Spring as much as what the regime was doing then. Or I think, if I remember clearly, he was telling stories of some of his relatives in Syria. So a lot of these people try to, I would say, forget their political affiliation and kind of merge themselves with the massive protest movement that was occurring at the time. And kind of that moment was defining who they are and who the regimes are at that time, and try to shape their future. As you can see, a lot of narratives are very hopeful, and we might now read them with kind of a little bit of disappointment that these kind of passionate narratives are not reflective of the reality that they anticipated, but they didn't get now.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, as you look back at the narratives en masse, what pattern do they follow? What sort of do these thinkers talk about themselves in the roles that they take during the revolution? Do they talk about fear? Do they talk about their comrades? Do they, as you said, do they talk about what life was before the revolution? Do they tell you about what they're expecting? What are some of the things that keep coming up? What are some trends?
Yeah, there is something that I should preface for this question, because I expected people to talk to me or their imagined readers the way they wanted. And for me, as someone who's, you know, shaping this process from the beginning, I tried actually, that's fine. We want them to tell their stories without any type of mediation. Except that because I wanted, you know, when you do documentaries, you assume everyone is saying things spontaneously. But we know that there is editing process. I didn't try to edit anything. But beforehand, I tried to give some kind of major guidelines for my participants so that when they start writing or telling their narratives, they kind of, okay, you have always great things to say. Why don't you follow these guidelines so that we will have a pattern as you expect to happen, so that we will have a diverse patterns in the narratives themselves. So I tried first to ask them, instead of, spending too much of your time cursing the regimes and showing how much bad they are, try, you know, to take a kind of a global look and see personally why you feel like what exactly they did to you. Just tell us personally. You don't need to, you know, just follow the narrative that's common, which we know. But we need to know exactly, like, as a person, you grow up in Yemen or Egypt, Libya, Syria. Why you felt like this is a right procedure for massive protest movement to remove these dictators? And I think that helped a lot for them to answer a major question that I was trying to get answers for, which is why these people joined the Arab Spring, not themselves only, in general, like why Arabs actually started the Arab Spring. And by answering this, as you may notice, they will go back maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago and tell stories of what happened, why they are not happy with the Mubarak regime, why they're not happy with Assad's regime, why they're not happy with Gaddafi. What did Gaddafi do in the past? What kind of brutalities he was involved in? Why Mubarak made Egypt the kind of dysfunctional on many aspects the country it was? Like, what is wrong with the health sector in Egypt? And I think some of the narratives focused on that. Corruption. How did they destroy constitutions by preparing their sons for the next generation dictators. That was a major question, like why you feel people actually should or did protest. The other question, what happened during the Arab Spring that you joined? So basically, I tried also to know from them what they did, because there is a tendency for people to say, oh, I'm not that significant. Why don't I, like, tell you what's going on, like a reporter for you? And I didn't want that. I'm sure there were many people doing this. I said I wanted to be individualized, personalized, like what you exactly did, what happened to you, who gave you the call to demonstrate on this day, what did you do, how did your family react to it, and so on. And that would be the second question, what happened, and the first question was why it happened. And I see the patterns are following these kind of major guidelines. Yeah, what are the spots that we see from the narratives? I mean, it's diverse, which is something I really feel very happy about. Some people, you know, told stories about their families, why they were not happy with them participating. Some of them focused on still the collective, like what their friends did. What are the moves people on Facebook did to get people organized, and then what the police did for participants, what kind of brutalities that we know for sure now happened, they encountered. Some of them, of course, this is the most intriguing and riveting part, I felt. Those who went to a prison in the process of the Arab Spring. And I feel I always want to go back to see how they were treated and what they said to the people who were torturing or trying to coerce them. People who witnessed fighting in Libya, for example, we have one narrative. Very interesting. You see kind of a flavor of the freedom fighter at the time, though I later became very suspicious about the whole concept of fighters against the regime, because I am totally against the armed conflict geared towards change. I don't believe personally this is the right way, but a lot of people at the time didn't know that would be eventually maybe a wrong thing to have. Maybe they were forced to it because they cannot find alternatives. Maybe it was an act of self-defense. Female author from Tunisia told a story about how her nephew, I guess, mm-hmm. was killed. That was very touching and very moving narrative, because we have encountered more of this type of narratives in Syria when we have, I mean, personally, I lost my nephew, I lost my uncle as a result of this war happening in Syria. Even though they were few stories we heard in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, more actually, I didn't have a chance before the book to actually meet someone who had a dear one fell in this process as a fallen hero. I think almost everything, every aspect of the Arab Spring that I can imagine now, looking back at them, I think was covered. Demonstrations, what they did, the Syrian narratives are very interesting, because I know how hard it is to even be part of a demonstration. I mean, this is unheard of before the Arab Spring in Syria. So I was always like very extremely interested to know every single detail about what happened, what the reaction of the security agents to that. I think they will be always reflective of what's going on, or what was going on in Syria. It's no longer the case where people can organize demonstrations anymore, actually, in Syria. So maybe that what we get in the Syrian chapter is unique, because for the last 3 years, nobody could actually be part of a demonstration in Syria at all, neither in the areas controlled by the regime or in the areas controlled by different factions or brigades or whatever they call themselves.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could pick some of the stories that you like the best.
Oh, I don't
talk about them.
That's not something I expected, but I don't think it's fair. I would try to be diplomatic here.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Pick a story and say this is the best. I think every story.
Maybe not the best, but the ones that moved you. For instance, the.
Tell me, I mean, I'm more interested about you, Azri, because I am too much, I would say, familiar with the stories.
What did I like?
Yeah, I would see maybe how you reacted to some of, because I went through some of the stories were maybe small paragraphs at the beginning, and I tried to push for more writing right. on the part of the author. So
I have to say, in the Egypt one, the one done by Adil Abdul, I don't know if it's
Ghaffar?
Abdul Ghaffar, yeah.
Yeah, I know him personally. He's a graduate student now somewhere in Europe, I guess in Australia.
Yeah, he's an activist, he's male, he's 32, and he lived in Cairo at that time,
but currently finishing his PhD, if not done now. I think he was somewhere in either in Europe or Australia, but I had been in contact with him constantly about his narrative as well as his future plans. Yeah, he didn't want to identify himself with his educational background, which is fine. But this is someone who I think is interested in political science. Someone who has this sophisticated style to narrate the story of Egyptians, why they had to revolt against Mubarak. And yeah, I agree with you. It's very moving, but maybe I should listen to you more about it.
I'm interested in this particular person because, you know, he seemed to be able to contextualize what was happening on the ground those first few days.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the day that he's talking about is actually January 25th. Mm-hmm. And he starts out with 8 a.m. And then by the time 4 p.m. comes around, as you said, I'm not surprised with the background that he has, that he was able to specifically pinpoint what was different about what was happening as opposed to protests that he had attended maybe in the past. Something changed during this protest or some things. And he was able to, or at least the way that he saw it, and he was able to voice that and sort of put that into words. And I thought that was really, really powerful. So I'm going to stop talking. I'm just wondering if you could tell us what it is, what the epiphany is that he...
I want to emphasize something here. In this kind of typical narrative of Egyptians, why they revolted. And a lot of times people nowadays feel like, oh, the Arab Spring shouldn't have started in the beginning because now we have a messier Arab world than the one before the Arab Spring. But at the same time, they forget that it was not just like the Arab people decided in one morning, hey, why don't we revolt? It's not. It might be a good thing. Well, why don't we take the risk? What's the reason? Maybe there is no reason. Let's just do it. No, actually, there are reasons, major reasons that whether the Arab Spring existed or not, people should pay attention to. For example, I'm glad you took me to Adil Abdul Ghaffar. He talked about what was labeled in Egypt as the hereditary project. Hereditary project is the one, it's the name or the term for these dictators, mostly four of them actually, Gaddafi, Mubarak, Ali Abdullah Saleh, and Bashar al-Assad. They were either preparing their sons or, like in the case of Bashar al-Assad, already a son of a dictator taking over the presidency in a constitutional democracy on paper and lording over Syrians. With disregard to the constitution. I mean, I was in Syria when he changed the constitution in 5-10 minutes, making the age of the president from 40 then to 34 his age at the time. Ali Abdullah Saleh was preparing his son, who is now making some news in even world media. Gaddafi was preparing Saif al-Islam, became a star in even Libyan politics before the demise of Gaddafi. And, of course, Hosni Mubarak. Now, he's saying something I want to read for your listeners, just a small paragraph. He said, personally, if you allow me.
Please, yes.
Yeah, personally, this so-called hereditary project has always infuriated me. I viewed it as an insult to Egypt. I mean, that's very understandable. Yeah, it's as an insult to Egypt, its people, and its history. Well, maybe history will show that that was normal. But yeah, for him, he believes this is an insult to expect sons taking over their parents. The Assad family in Syria had completed their hereditary project. Was this to happen in Egypt too? Disbelief mixed with anger as I watched Mubarak's regime advance the project bit by bit over the years, cementing it in Egyptian politics and economy. I mean, this is a very eloquent way of describing what was going on in Egypt and why people felt their dignity is actually being affected by this type of dictator who is ignoring their constitution, ignoring the history, the modern history of Egypt, like never happened before, where a president will pass the presidency to his son. Why Mubarak? I mean, he's not better than Hosni Sadat or Jamal Abdel Nasser, who never thought even. It's like unbelievable how when we compare it to the recent history of Egypt, that this would happen in Egypt. But he's saying that the economy of Egypt, as well as the politics, were kind of the fronts by which Mubarak was trying to advance this project. So basically, you have Jamal taking care of Egyptian economy for his own benefit. All the cronies of Egyptian regime are being affiliated with the family, and they are helping this project to happen.
Jamal being the son that was supposed to take over.
Yeah, and it's not like he's only involved in politics. There were so many economy projects that he has his hands in. And for the purpose of making himself a powerful person in Egypt and at the same time preparing him for the presidency, which was almost happening. I wouldn't be surprised had the Arab Spring not existed that Jamal would be now the president of Egypt, because, you know, the same rhetoric will exist. He's the best available. He's already involved. He already knows what's going on in Egypt. And every media in Egypt is controlled and owned by a wealthy person affiliated to Mubarak family. So basically, you'll have the talking heads in Egypt kind of cheering for him.
Right. So going back to what you said earlier, you said that we just talked about the fact that there were quite solid reasons, this hereditary situation being one of them, why the revolution was sort of right, the situation was ripe and ready for the revolution to happen. But I think what I found most amazing about the stories in the book was every once in a while in one of these narratives, I'd come across this particular person telling their story, explaining why it went from just a few people protesting into the street into a massive movement that finally toppled the dictator. What are your insights about having sort of gathered and thought about all these stories together? Could you tell us a little bit about that? And I like I said, I was interested specifically in Adel's story because he says something amazing. He has an amazing moment there where he points to this. It's on page 57 at the bottom of the page. He says, then something incredible happened.
Yeah, how people actually moved from being, as he called them, and I think others said, bystanders to participants. Yeah, not only the local pattern, as you are describing, how like a snowballing thing happened in Egypt, but also I think a lot of them said why they picked up the revolution in their country and what was influencing them from outside. So if you read the Yemeni narratives, you feel there's a pattern of them saying, oh, the Tunisians did it, the Egyptians had done it, why don't we do it? In the same way that Adil and others say people at the beginning were just bystanders, they were not necessarily involved. But then when they see what's going on, how maybe the police would react to the participants of the demonstration or the sit-in, they will be actually drawn to this movement because they feel these are their sons and daughters and these people care about Egypt. They are not, as the media depicted them, as vandalizers or as people who are destroying Egypt. On the contrary, they are ready to die for Egypt. And I think that led, I would say, millions of people to actually believe in the ethics of the protest movement. In Libya, the same. People were so much not buying the media that was depicting Muammar al-Gaddafi as kind of the victim of his own people. On the contrary, it was the opposite. He was threatening that he will smash it by force, and a lot of people were trying to protect their country by standing in front of this brutal dictator who was almost giving orders for his army to crush some restive areas. Moment of, I would say, kind of the emergence of massive protest is actually narrated clearly in these stories where you see how people were reacting to what's going on in the spot of the Arab Spring, whether in a bus ride in Tunisia or by people watching it in Egypt or Yemen. And how it went from one country to another, you see there is a pattern of we have to do something. We have been suffering from the same experience. One thing I should add, though, Al Jazeera has been mentioned a lot in these narratives. So it's Arabia, which is kind of not necessarily by name, but Arab media actually, not only social media, helped a lot to make the Arab Spring kind of the norm for certain countries, though, not all of them, for good reasons, I mean. But the Al Jazeera was trying to, you know, play the game of, yeah, this is a rosy thing, covering Egypt, for example, live all the time, and trying to create a kind of a very overwhelming culture of everything is now shaken in the Arab world. And eventually that led to, I think, in Syria, for example, to being involved in some unethical provoking, I would say, on the from these media venues to make it almost always like black and white. Mm. And I feel now, as we are encountering the Arab media with the post-Arab Spring, we feel what are the issues that these agendas that they have. Not necessarily, I mean, they were creating anything by themselves. They were trying, you know, to cover. The Arab Spring started regardless of the Arab media. But they would tell you in the narratives, I would say, with a sense of innocence that this is what they were showing. But later we realized that it was not necessarily innocent from the part of these media venues. They tried to maybe romanticize some aspects of the Arab Spring and neglect the others. Like you in Syria, for example, you hear stories or the news stories from the fronts, people who were fighting Bashar al-Assad. But they would give hardly enough space for peaceful activists, for example. So Al Jazeera wouldn't make a lot of effort maybe to connect with someone like Kerman or the kind of rational approach to the Arab Spring, which is to keep up with the same principles, peaceful demonstrations geared towards democratic change of regimes rather than romanticizing armed conflicts as they did in Syria, for example. I mean, I think that's personal for me, but yeah, a lot of people were, I think they believed that there were no agendas. It was just neutral coverage of the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. which I don't think was the case by Arab media.
Right. So what would you say were the reasons that people's fear sort of disappeared at the moment when they were confronted with the police? It seems that in a lot of these revolutions, it seems like it came to, or it came down to the moment when the people were sort of faced with the riot police and they stood their ground instead of running. What do you think caused that?
I think I heard this term a lot in the book, the barrier of fear mm-hmm. that was actually broken. And I don't think I need to elaborate that much about this, but it was in the book. I think few people said it clearly, that this fear that existed for maybe decades in the consciousness of Arab people, at that time it broke. I heard from someone who was in Syria that some of the Syrian protesters who would go on Fridays to show their solidarity with other Syrians being sniped by al-Assad's regime, he told me that he saw someone who was during the rituals to prepare for Jum'ah prayer in Syria, they would read, I think they would read al-Fatiha. So basically they will announce that they are ready to die, which means when they wash for the prayer, they also wash for themselves to potentially be dead. I think that tells a lot. I mean, I am very moved by this. I don't have enough theorization to explain it, but I feel like you. Like, how this happened? Where does this courage and indifference to human safety come from? And I think that's the reason why it was either successful, because people were unstoppable in Egypt, like you cannot really stand against them, or at the same time became so messy, like in Syria or even Yemen, because there are thousands of people who are ready to die just to remove Bashar al-Assad. And we are losing the best of these people day by day because they're not afraid anymore. And I have heard people saying before, even after finishing the book, saying that we don't care if we die. That's normal, but at least we will not let this dictator enjoy his life without hearing people saying enough is enough. So I think it's potential in every human being to at one point feel that enough is enough. It's either you live without saying anything, or you feel like you will say it, you will voice yourself regardless of the consequences. And I think Egyptians, Tunisians, Yemenis, Libyans, Syrians reach that moment where they feel welcome to death. If by death we're gonna maybe prepare a better life for our sons and daughters.
Right. Did you want to talk about anything else specifically that we haven't talked about?
I don't recall. I mean, I feel honestly that maybe I talk too much.
Oh no, this is your moment to talk as much as you want.
Yeah, I want to actually, if I have a word, maybe a few words, I would thank my participants. I think they made it, not only they made the Arab Spring a reality, but also they made this book project a reality. And without them, this book wouldn't happen.
Are we going to have a book two? An updated sort of follow-up project?
I'm working on the Syrian version of the Arab Spring. And the book is titled Syrian Revolution and Civil War. So unfortunately, the Arab Spring has turned, for reasons that are not necessarily the product of people themselves, had turned to be bloody in a country like Syria or Yemen as well as Libya. So maybe now people have the time to theorize what went wrong and why people like the participants I have in my book were not necessarily the ones who are now taken over. I mean, I know for sure some of the people I'm still in contact with, they are marginalized. They have nothing to say or to do with the reality of their countries now. How this happened, again, maybe we can blame the Arab media, other Arab regimes. Maybe the people were not happy. I mean, the Big Brother was not happy with the fact that liberal and freedom lover, loving people like these people will take over, because maybe they will. These people were able to excite drastic change. And maybe the picture of the Arab world as we see it now is that there were limits put to people. Like, you can change Mubarak, yes, but maybe you cannot. You're not allowed to change the entire regime. Maybe you can remove Gaddafi, but you wouldn't be in charge of your country. There would be factions that will try to take over. Weapons talk louder than the voices of these people nowadays. Deeply rooted politics, even the same politics that existed before the Arab Spring, are now controlling the media. These people cannot have a say. This is a different reality. And unfortunately, when I read the book, I feel like, yeah, this is what eventually we wanted, a better result of this, because they were working hard on it. Unfortunately, you feel like the outcome was not as they wanted. Not that they have anything to do with it. It was still out of their control. So basically, they moved from one reality to face so many other realities, and they are still in need of, I would say, intellectual revolutions. This culture of still feeling that you need to have a strong ruler who can suppress voices like these is still there in the Arab world. A lot of people are still, they still believe that someone like Mubarak is better to Egypt than a democratically elected leader. And also, I think there is a need for re-examining our Arab culture, like what kind of critical thinking skills that we feel not present. They were not nursed by the regimes for decades. And now, as we see these regimes are gone, we see the result of the lack of good education, the lack of critical thinking, the lack of civil societies, and the lack of maybe independent grassroots groups that can take over. We see now the Islamists are more organized, because they were working on this for years, even before the Arab Spring, and they are trying to take over. People who are forming militias, they are more powerful than civil societies. In Libya, for example, I sense some kind of civil society from the narratives that I read in Libya. But I feel now I don't see that that's becoming a reality. All what we see is Al-Qaeda affiliates are running from one place to another, controlling it. And if anyone like these participants opposed them, they would be killed or be labeled as non-Muslims. And so, unfortunately, a lot of these people, their countries are paying the price of the dictators who were not necessarily preparing people for this moment. It was the same in Syria. It's either me or chaos. They were always playing on this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's the same. Now, see it in Egypt, in Yemen, in Libya, that, yeah, if the dictators are gone, they didn't prepare the country to function in a sound system, because there was no system at all. and you will see chaos for maybe years to come. But I hope that, I mean, people, they know exactly what they want, regardless of the means by which they will achieve what they desire. But I am sure these the same people will exist always in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. People who want democracy, people who are not necessarily in love with the armed conflicts. They want to have a nice family, good education, better health sector. These are the same goals that motivated them to remove these dictators. I hope same grievances will drive them to remove all these bad players that we see in the Arab world after the dictators.
Thank you for joining us, Asad Saleh. Looking forward to the second project. Is it also going to be narratives? Is it going to be No, it's not.
Okay. Yeah, I think I did my share.
Okay. All right. Well, wishing you the best, and hopefully we can talk with each other once the second book is out.
Well, I also would like to thank you so much for arranging this and conducting it with me. I really appreciate it.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you to you and to your listeners. I appreciate it.